Okay, so I'll go to my native language here. Thank you for coming. So, as Michelle mentioned, all of my work for the first 15 years of my research career was on electronic systems and mesoscopic electrons, and I was very interested in complex wave phenomena, and I discovered in the 90s that there were very interesting complex wave phenomena in microcavities for lasers and in nonlinear optics, where you have waves with nonlinearity. So I sort of adiabatically began switching my attention towards that field, but taking the point of view of someone coming from mesoscopic physics and therefore hopefully bringing something original from a different perspective. Because there are a number of sort of conventional assumptions that are made. Now, on the other hand, I came with very little actual knowledge of lasers. I think it would have been very interesting to record my answer to the question, what is a laser, in 1993. I think I would have completely either said nothing or said something completely incorrect. So, and part of this exercise has been for myself to understand what is a laser, and how well do we understand them, coming from the point of view of a condensed matter physicist, where in some sense I'm expecting to be able to draw quantitative theory plots through data, which interestingly I found they were not necessarily expecting to do in this field. So first I should say, I consulted Michelle, and I know there may be a few people here who are not experts in physics at all. Well, probably they all know something about physics. But I included a few sort of very elementary, non-mathematical slides and some historical slides at the beginning just for fun. I'll go through those quickly, and there will be technical things to come after that. So I'd like to thank my collaborators. This work began with a student now on the faculty of Princeton, Hakan Turici, and has continued with these members of my group and in close collaboration with my colleague Wei Cao, who's an experimenter in laser physics and optics at Yale. And what I'm going to tell you about is a new approach to steady-state lasing theory, which we call SALT. That's steady-state ab initio laser theory, where we treat lasers as scattering systems, very much like the Landauer-Biedecker approach that was so successful in mesoscopic electron physics, and also not that different from the approach that you heard about from Michelle, you've been hearing about in these lectures. And this actually leads to a more efficient computational method that allows you to treat complex modern lasers like random lasers, which actually were essentially beyond the computational capabilities of people before our work. And then in the last part of the talk, I'm going to tell you something amusing about this thing that we colloquially call the anti-laser, where using the concept of time reversal symmetry, you realize that there's a way to coherently control absorption, which is related to essentially running a laser backwards, hence the terminology anti-laser. Okay, so here are the very general popular slides that I'll go through quickly. The laser was invented in 1960 by Ted Maimon, who did not win the Nobel Prize. This is the flash lamp that pumped the laser. And they had a big celebration of 50 years of the laser just 2 years ago. And that same year, the anti-laser was invented. We call it a coherent perfect absorber. Demonstration of the effect came out in Science a little bit afterwards. And we called it in our press release the anti-laser, which conjured up all sorts of science fiction ideas. And so it was covered by major news outlets, including Fox News, who explained it this way. Dear James Bond, next time a laser beam threatens to cut you in two, try switching it into reverse. So that was kind of fun. And we're in year two of the anti-laser, which at the end of the lecture I'll tell you what it is and a little bit about what the point is. Okay, so what's a laser? Well, what's special about light from a laser? Where do we get light from? Well, for the first 100,000 years of the human species, we burnt things. And for the last 120 years, we've been heating up wires, which is a very messy, inefficient, and disorderly light source. And the goal of the laser physics was to create light as a coherent wave with a very narrow frequency range, or a single frequency nu. Okay. Now, we knew how to generate electromagnetic waves electronically by about 1880. So first, of course, Maxwell showed that there was this unified theory of electromagnetic waves. In 1887, Heinrich Hertz generated them and detected them and using electronically. And by 1899, we had, you know, serious radio technology. And the basic idea electronically is that you have some kind of a electromagnetic oscillator, and you create an oscillating dipole, and you send out a traveling wave at the frequency at which your dipole oscillates. It took me a long time to get that right, so you know, I want to show that again. Thank you. I have an even fancier one later. Now the truth in advertising, a radio electromagnetic wave and a laser generated electromagnetic wave are basically the same thing. Okay, it's a single frequency, it's ordered, it's got a specific field pattern that's generated, not exactly by the same mechanism. But light is a billion times higher frequency than the frequencies of radio. And so how do you generate an AC current in an atom, an oscillating dipole in an atom? Well, first you need to know the equations of motion of the atom, which they didn't know in 1899. So these folks stepped in, and over about 25 years worked that out. I should have squeezed in Dirac, since he was so important for quantum electrodynamics. So the basic idea is that energy levels of the atom that are discrete, the electrons orbit as clouds of probability, and when an electron drops down between one of the two energy levels, you emit light according to Planck's formula. Actually, Planck didn't really say that. Einstein did, but anyway, that's Planck's formula. And this is really I actually took me a long time to understand that this is really equivalent to the same oscillating dipole. So your electron cloud, see, look at that. Electron cloud is oscillating, and it's sort of like a spherical antenna. Actually, it's like a dipole antenna, but anyway. Okay, and then we move on to Einstein, who enunciated the principle of the laser, same principle that you were using in your talk over and over again, of stimulated and spontaneous emission. So let's just simplify our atoms to two levels. Of course, now with a lot of effort in mesoscopic physics, we do have very nice two-level atoms that we can engineer. So light comes in and it's absorbed, and then it can be emitted, and even with no external radiation, it will spontaneously relax down, and this is the quantum effect. Actually, that's the quantum part, is spontaneous emission, and it adds intrinsic randomness, and Einstein actually pointed this out in 1916. He was the first person that actually said that quantum mechanics at this level, well, he didn't call it quantum mechanics because they didn't call it mechanics then, but the quantum theory had intrinsic randomness. That was not something that Bohr or anyone had said before Einstein said it, but he felt it was sort of an intermediate stage that would get solved, which it didn't. Okay, so that's spontaneous emission, but then if I already have an electron in an excited state and I excite the atom, then I can more rapidly stimulate its emission. And this is really a classical effect of driving an antenna as opposed to, as opposed to being absorbed. Okay. And now the principle of the laser is that if you externally pump energy into this ensemble of atoms so that you have more electrons in an upper level than in a lower level, so you have a population inversion. And then you send in a light wave. Okay, then as you go through, you get both stimulated emission, okay, and you also get some absorption, but if you have an inverted state, the net effect is amplification and not absorption. And we can model that by saying that our medium in this non-equilibrium state has a negative imaginary part of the index of refraction, which leads to amplification of the wave. Okay, so that's light amplified by stimulated emission of radiation, which you might think was a laser, but it isn't actually what we call a laser anymore. Okay, it's not a laser yet. It's an amplifier. Okay, so what you need to do to get a laser is you need to put the atoms in a between mirrors or in a resonator, and then there'll be some you would have to invert it. Sorry, you have to invert it. So there has to be energy flowing in some other form. Okay. And then when you have spontaneous emission, it bounces around, causing stimulated emission of the other more, and you get this cascade. But some of it also is leaking out, which is the usable emission of the laser. And you don't reach the oscillation threshold until you have this condition satisfied, that the magnitude of n prime, the imaginary part of the index, is related to how hard you're pumping. As you get it, make it bigger, eventually you reach this condition where the loss equals the gain, and then you reach the threshold for self-organized oscillation. So laser is a self-organized oscillator due to this feedback here where you emit and then it circulates and gives you more stimulated emission. So that's a light oscillator by stimulated emission of radiation. And this is an old joke, but you guys are mostly young. So yes, it should have been called a loser, but they, for some reason, chose to call it a laser instead. Now, this all sounds easy, like pretty obvious, right? But it wasn't obvious that this could work. Very famous people, so this was done first by Charles H. Townes, and famous people, you know, literally Bohr and von Neumann were kind of telling him it violated the uncertainty principle. I think they finally changed their minds. And more specifically, so what he did was he used an oscillation of the ammonia molecule, which he sent in the excited state in a molecular beam to create the maser, which is the same principle as the laser at microwaves. But when he was trying to do this, which took him about 2 or 3 years between 51 and 53, he was at Columbia, and two Nobel laureates, I.I. Rabi and Polycarp Kush, one day came into the lab and told him, "You're wasting the department's money." That was back when people were sharing their money in the department. So, you know it's not going to work. We know it's not going to work. Why don't you just stop? And Townes said, "I simply told them that I thought I'd had a reasonable chance and I would continue. I was then indeed thankful that I had tenure." So he did succeed, and then he did win the Nobel Prize for succeeding in 1964. Okay. Now, the jump from 24 gigahertz to, which was the original ammonia maser, to light frequencies, 400 terahertz, took about 7 years, but while there were certainly important things, the basic principle had been established. That may be part of the reason that Ted Hughes, Maiman didn't win the Nobel Prize. But anyway, so in May 1960, this ruby with the flash lamp and a little kind of resonator here was the first laser, but very shortly thereafter, the first continuous wave laser, the helium neon gas laser, was invented, which was actually useful. The ruby laser wasn't very useful except for cutting James Bond in two. And then in 1970, the semiconductor diode laser was invented, which really changed the game for the consumer. So in 2008, a billion of these were made because they're in all your CD readers and DVD players and so on, although that's probably going out now. I wonder what's going to happen. Okay, and the Nobel Prize was awarded in 2000 for that, and it's not widely appreciated, or maybe this audience appreciates it, but the laser is a critical enabler of the internet. because all the long-haul communications requires single-mode semiconductor lasers, the DFB laser, main thing, and these fiber amplifiers called EDFAs, which will regenerate the signal after 50 kilometers or so on. Okay, so that's all the history and background. Now a little bit up to modern life and what I'm interested in. Okay, so in the modern era, last, say, 15 years, there's one of the frontiers of laser physics. There are several frontiers, but one of the frontiers has been micro lasers, lasers that you can make and for integrated optical circuits very cheaply and very small, and also research lasers related to just making small lasers. So this is a micro disc laser. This is a micro toroid laser made at Caltech. This is a deformed cylinder laser, which I was involved in with the Bell Labs group. This is a photonic crystal where you have a defect mode that's like a cavity, and you put a gain medium, so it's a photonic crystal laser. And this is actually a laser too, which is kind of surprising. It's just an aggregate of random zinc oxide nanoparticles with no mirrors at all. The light just diffuses around and gets amplified by the gain medium here in the zinc oxide. And this was pioneered by a number of people, including my colleague Wei Cao at Yale. And when this came out, one of the issues is this kind of laser just like the conventional laser? Is it fundamentally different? And there was no good theory to answer that question. Okay. This is the output from this random laser. So you see narrow lasing lines like you would expect from a conventional laser. Okay. Now, I was not working originally on random lasers. I was interested in lasers like this, where when the light bounces around, the rays undergo chaotic scattering. And those of you in mesoscopic physics know that there was a good 10 or 15 years where we had electron resonators and quantum dots that were being studied, where electrons would come in through a lead here and go out through a lead there, and you'd get all sorts of interesting fluctuation phenomena because of the chaotic scattering, which you could describe by random matrix theory and semi-classical quantum theory. And there were very detailed experiments done. So when I looked at these kind of disk resonators for light, I thought, well, some similar things would occur there, and that's how I got interested in this. So this thing was made as a microlaser, a quantum cascade microlaser. It was made at various shapes, from circular to these kind of oval shapes, and they emitted a very nice bright laser pattern with the shape of a kind of, you see a bow tie or butterfly here, that's a certain periodic orbit of the resonator. And what you found was that as you went from the circular cylindrical shape resonator to these more deformed resonators, the output power increased by two orders of magnitude. And that was not something we had predicted, and actually we didn't understand it. And it turned out nobody else did. And it also turned out that for a complicated resonator in two or three dimensions like this, when you're talking about a nonlinear effect above the lasing threshold, there was no theory. So I was kind of surprised to find that there wasn't some high-powered theory that, some ab initio theory where you could actually put a line through this data with some not too many fitting parameters. And that was part of the motivation. This was 1998, to say, well, what is the fundamental obstacle to doing something quantitative in this complex system, which, by the way, was emitting not just one frequency, but several frequencies, so it's called multimode. So that was the motivation to go into this, and I discovered that, and this was, as I said, very similar to mesoscopic resonators, where we had been able to do some things. So at the time, what I learned was that, or what I have learned subsequently, is that semi-classical laser theory was developed in the early 60s, I'll explain what semi-classical means, by various great men, Willis Lamb, Marlon Scully, Herman Hocken are three of the earliest pioneers. And There was an extensive further development when semiconductor lasers became common in the 1980s. But actually, the laser by that time, by 1990, became a tool, and the electromagnetic aspects of this being an open system and a strongly nonlinear system, not to mention the new aspect that I'm interested in of spatial complexity of the resonator, they were never treated in these early works, partially because they really weren't thinking computationally at this early stage. They wanted to draw a box around their final equations. So what is actually done now, literally done, even in companies, et cetera, are either very brute force simulations of the laser equations, often with approximations because they're too slow to simulate in full, or heuristic non-predictive arguments, qualitative arguments. And what we wanted was a more analytic method, more unified approach, which would include both random lasers and regular lasers, and maybe ultimately a method that would give you ability to predict and design lasers more quantitatively. Okay. All right. So, and there was, as I say, some connection to mesoscopic physics, in my mind anyway. So we're familiar in mesoscopic physics with this picture, which I call the Landauer-Boedeker octopus, where you have some sample. This will be some actually microscale electronic circuit described by a scattering matrix. And we'll imagine that there are these perfect leads, sort of like Michel's transmission lines, which take the electrons out to reservoirs, fermionic reservoirs in thermal equilibrium, but at different chemical potentials. So when the chemical potentials are different, then a current can actually flow in the ground state of this system. Okay, so it describes what we would normally call a non-equilibrium system. It was then derived fairly rigorously that the current into lead M is related to the scattering matrix of the system through the transmission coefficients defined here in this famous set of relations where the ratio E squared over H, the quantum conductance, appears. And at finite temperature, the Fermi function, actually its derivative in the reservoir, then comes in to these equations. Now, more rigorously, you can actually write a rigorous quantum theory here. You can say, well, the wave functions are this continuous set of scattering states with an incoming wave in a particular lead, reflected waves into all the other leads with some channel functions phi, and reflected into the same lead and transmitted into all the other leads. Okay, and then you can actually second quantize this theory. You can say that the ground state wave function is this psi, I call it psi meso, many body wave function. It's just this product over up to the occupied levels of all these states being created from the vacuum. Okay, so it is a Slater determinant, but it's a Slater determinant that actually carries current in and out to infinity. And there are different sectors associated with the different reservoirs. So you define the current operators in the sort of straightforward way, and then you calculate the expectation value of the current operator in this fermionic wave function, and magically you recover, you use the usual fermionic type of relations here, et cetera, and you find Landauer-Boedeker equations, which were always justified just by kind of counting arguments, somewhat non-rigorous counting arguments. Now at least you have a model where they rigorously appear. And then when you calculate the variance of the currents, you find the shot noise and the mesoscopic shot noise and the Johnson noise come out automatically. Okay. Now this is really nice and simple once you understand it. Of course, it wasn't really understood for a lot of years. But it's a Hermitian, number-conserving, fermionic, many-body, but non-interacting, in this case, quantum system with the thermal fluctuations, et cetera. Okay, so my idea was, well, let's treat lasers sort of like this, but there are a lot of complications. which I will now mention. So how's the laser different? Well, I have bosons, not fermions. So when I take their expectation value, I'll get a Bose function. If they're photons, mu will be zero, of course. The sample and the reservoirs can coincide in the sense that I'm going to have to include thermal effects in the sample. And the asymptotic region can be non-interacting. I'm neglecting the fact that there'll be a background of thermal radiation because at optical frequencies, that's not important. So the photons will be free asymptotically, incoming and outgoing, but I have interactions with matter in the sample. Very early on in laser physics, it was understood that you could represent the inversion of the medium by a negative temperature. So that's how you represent this non-equilibrium inversion of the medium. And number, of course, of photons is not conserved, and the wave equation is non-Hermitian. And technically, this was the biggest problem that people hadn't really treated, in, as far as I'm concerned, fully. Okay. Now, of course, for lasing, we don't have anything incoming from infinity except noise. We only have outgoing waves. When we go to quantum theory, there'll be noise, of course. So the scattering matrix becomes, and the scattering matrix becomes a nonlinear object above that threshold for oscillation. But all these things are actually complications that are substantial, but still it turns out you can do something useful and quantitative. So that's what I'll tell you about now. Okay. So let's see. I didn't see when I started. I should keep track. Did I start 11:30? Okay. All right. So I better get going then. Okay. So we're going to treat our laser as a scattering object where there's a cavity with a dielectric function epsilon cavity, which is linear and doesn't react to the emission of laser light, and a gain medium, which is being pumped so that it will be inverted, which will then shift the dielectric constant. This is really the susceptibility, if you like, actually, delta epsilon g. And it will have the property that when the medium is inverted, the index of refraction, N2, the imaginary part is negative, which corresponds to amplification, as I said earlier. And in general, the S matrix that follows from this, that scatters a set of incoming waves, alpha, to outgoing waves, beta, will be nonlinear and will depend on how strong the inputs are. But turns out, not only is it nonlinear, but it's non-unitary because it has this non-Hermitian, the wave equation has this non-Hermitian complex potential, if you like, here. Okay, so it's a very different from the unitary S matrices, et cetera, that we're used to. So alpha will come in, and in general, more will come out. And I'm describing the S matrix of an amplifier. But it turns out I can neglect the nonlinearity when finding the lasing thresholds. So let me tell you about that. Okay, above threshold, I won't be able to neglect it. Okay, now first, this writing things in general in terms of an S matrix is just not something that was done in general in laser theory, although sometimes in one dimension it was done. So for the lasing mode, beta goes out, something goes out, but nothing goes in. So alpha here tends to zero, the input. Okay, and that corresponds to the S matrix going to infinity, which means there must be a pole. And the question is, can this happen for a real frequency, for a real solution of Maxwell's equations? And the answer is no, it can't happen if I have a passive cavity. You know, if n is real here, then the S matrix will be unitary, and the poles will be fundamentally complex, and you can't have lasing, which is not surprising. Okay, so let's just illustrate that with a simple 1D uniform dielectric cavity with a perfect mirror at one end and a partially reflecting interface at the other end. Okay, so we can then calculate the poles of the scattering matrix for this simple object. There they are. These are the resonances. They tell you the natural frequencies of the system, but they're not physical Maxwell solutions because they require a complex frequency inside and outside the resonator. Okay, now we add the gain medium and we pump it to invert it. And as we pump harder, we can keep calculating the scattering matrix of this thing. And what we'll find is that the poles move upwards and eventually one of them reaches the real axis. And that's the oscillation threshold. Okay, the first one will be the oscillation threshold. Now, for this simple system, I just have this complex wave equation. Oh, and the fact that they don't move straight up is because I've put the atomic transition frequency of the gain medium here. So there's a tendency for the frequencies to get pulled towards that. We call this solution a threshold lasing mode, TLM, with a certain frequency related to its wave vector. So I'm going to use frequency and wave vector interchangeably. And it's just a sine wave here, but it's a sine wave of a complex wave vector, so it's actually got some sinh and cosh in it, and it amplifies. But then outside, it's just a free outgoing plane wave. So these are now the threshold solutions, okay, of this pole on the real axis. But we do have a problem because actually this S matrix would say that, you know, if I put anything finite in, then I'd get infinite out. So what happens is, as it starts emitting light, the nonlinearity becomes important to stabilize the solution at some finite value. So you do need to add the nonlinearity. This calculation tells me how hard I need to pump for the laser to turn on and what the mode looks like, but it doesn't tell me the amplitude until I add the nonlinear effect, which I'm about to do. And I'll explain what that is. If I pump harder, I will find that others of these also turn on. So that's called multimode lasing. And I'll need to describe that with a nonlinear S matrix. Okay. So what we do is we use these non-Hermitian solutions. This is a non-Hermitian differential equation once I have that complex index of refraction. And let me show it here. This is the solution of, these are non-Hermitian solutions with non-Hermitian wave equation. Okay. So what we do is we use those kinds of solutions to solve the problem in steady state, even in the nonlinear regime. And here are the papers that give all the technical details. Here I'm going to give a very brief overview. Okay. So first, let me return. What are the lasing equations that I talked about simulating? Well, first, in semi-classical theory, you just don't quantize the fields yet. You just use Maxwell's equations. The gain medium appears as a source in Maxwell's equations here. And if we do this kind of semi-classical theory, it's not semi-classical in the sense of WKB. It's semi-classical in the sense that we don't have the quantum noise. So we don't have quantization of the electric field, no spontaneous emission, and no laser line width at this level of the theory. Later in the talk, I'll reintroduce that. Okay. In the simplest theory that people study, you just take two-level atoms described by a polarization and an inversion with some atomic frequency omega A, and you write the equations of motion for their expectation values coupled to the Maxwell equation, and these are then what was written down literally in 1963 by Hawken and Lamb independently. Okay. And there are some phenomenological parameters in this theory that I'll mention. So this, you know, they're differential equations, but they're non-trivial. They're damp-driven, non-linear system in space and time. So this is not that easy to solve. You put in phenomenologically the relaxation of the inversion. That's called gamma parallel. That's like 1 over T1 in NMR terminology. And you put in relaxation of the polarization or dephasing, which is 1 over T2 in that terminology. Those are put in phenomenologically. And then you put in the drive, the pump. That's the pump. That's the pump, which is the external drive so that the inversion doesn't relax down to a negative value. And then finally, you notice that you have these nonlinear terms, which then make the Maxwell equation effectively a nonlinear equation. Okay. And as we've written this, it's done for an arbitrary cavity, arbitrary gain, arbitrary openness, et cetera, which is not how it was done typically. Okay. But the simplification we make is we study only the steady-state multi-periodic solutions or multi-mode lasing. with no phase relationship between the different modes, and this is valid with this approximation that the inversion, that the polarization dephases much more rapidly than the inversion, which is true in solid state lasers for sure. Okay. Now the outline of what we do is the following. So what's the relation to this S matrix picture? Since I have this coupled system, it's not obvious what the relationship is, but at threshold, it turns out the field only starts continuously from zero. So the inversion is the same as the external pump at threshold in these units. Okay, so in this equation for the polarization, I can replace D, a dynamical variable, by D0, a constant here. And then I have a linear relationship between P and E in this equation, which I can then go to the Fourier domain replace P by something depending on E and the pump in the Maxwell equation. And when I do that, oh, that's what I get. I get the same equation I was talking about earlier, this linear non-Hermitian wave equation, where we now have a formula for delta epsilon G, or the susceptibility, involving the pump and the atomic frequency and the width of the gain curve in this case. Okay, and we call this square root of a Lorentzian factor, gamma mu, for short. Okay, now above threshold, I don't have this simple linear S matrix here. Instead, I have this kind of mode competition that I'm going to tell you about in a second. So if we look at this equation for the dynamics of the inversion of the medium, you see here I have the product of E and P. And if I assume a steady state where there are several modes oscillating at frequencies k mu in the electric field and in the polarization, then when I multiply them together, I get these beating terms at the difference frequency, which should drive some dynamics of D. And the approximation that we make is that these interference terms average out. Okay. If I have a single mode, we don't have to make that approximation. This is actually dd dt, d dot is zero. But in the multimode case, this is an approximation which Hocken has shown is valid in the approximation gamma parallel, much less than gamma perp that I already mentioned. Okay. Now let me show through this movie where the nonlinearity arises. Okay, so what I have here is an integration of the Maxwell block equations, or the laser equations I just showed you in time, where the purple here is a pulse of electric field to get the thing started. And it's the same simple cavity that I showed you earlier with a partially reflecting mirror here and a perfect mirror here. Okay, let's go. So the pulse escapes. It looks like maybe we don't have a laser, but it turns out we're above the lasing threshold, so this little bit of remaining intensity gets fed back and somehow magically does this thing, which I think is really cool. And now it's emitting laser radiation actually in two frequencies, two modes. And now here's the next phase. The green is the inversion. Previously, it was being uniformly pumped and the atoms were uniformly inverted. But now you see that you're developing this grating in space, because where the electric field is big, I have much more stimulated emission than where it's small, and therefore it can't, for the same pump, I can't invert the atoms as much here as here. And that is where you have now nonlinear feedback on the system, which changes the actual cavity, changes the lasing modes, decreases the average gain. I've decreased on average the inversion, therefore the gain, therefore it becomes harder for the other modes to turn on. So that's the hard thing to treat, which our theory treats really well. Okay, so this is the active cavity with laser emission, which is different from the passive cavity. This is what we solve using our method. Okay, so at threshold, I showed you this equation here, just a linear non-Hermitian equation. That's the pump. I remind you, this is just the square root of a Lorentzian that it contains the information about the atomic transition. Okay. Now, above threshold, using this approximation, we're able to show that we have what looks like a similar equation, okay, except I've put a tilde over the D, and that hides a multitude of sins, because now actually the effective pump depends on all the other modes. So this is actually a set of nonlinear equations. And we have to find out how many solutions exist. They're purely outgoing at infinity. But it turns out we can do this. We can solve these nonlinear coupled equations, self-consistent equations. And after the first mode turns on, we can include the nonlinear effects and figure out when the next mode is going to turn on and what it's going to look like, because it's going to be a little distorted from what it would have been. Okay. And from this theory, we can calculate all the thresholds, frequencies, amplitudes, output power, emission patterns, internal fields, but not the noise properties. Okay. Since the laser intensity actually rises continuously at threshold, the linear analysis that gave us the threshold, the first threshold, is correct, because this is negligible at threshold. At the second threshold, third threshold, it's not. So eventually we'll be able to figure out how many modes are lasing and what their intensities are, et cetera. Okay. Now, one more detailed slide about how the method works. I'm going to go through this quickly because I want to get to results and I want to get to the anti-laser. But anyway, for if there are a few connoisseurs. So these are the equations. This H of R is what we call the hole burning term that's nonlinear here in the denominator. We've now allowed, we've changed our notation, so the lasing field we're now calling psi mu. And we now allow a non-uniform pump, which is a very important thing that they usually neglect in laser theories. Okay, and we have to expand the solution of specific basis set. So we write a linear non-Hermitian equation with an eigenvalue eta here and purely outgoing boundary conditions, same profile as the pump in our system. Okay, and we can solve these eigenvalues and eigenvectors here, but they're not orthogonal in Hermitian, they're bi-orthogonal. We call them constant flux states. Oops, I don't know why that happened. Okay. And what is the meaning of this eigenvalue? This is all the possible values of the susceptibility which would lead to lasing at K, if I could just create that susceptibility. Okay, that's what this is. And when I then set it equal to the actual threshold susceptibility, I find the real lasing frequencies and thresholds. That's what I do. And the other solutions, besides the one which gives me the lowest threshold, gives me a basis set for the nonlinear solution. So I expand the nonlinear solution this way, and I have a nonlinear equation for these coefficients, which I can solve efficiently using this basis set. In fact, I only need one term at threshold, so that's why it's so rapidly convergent. So that's actually the technical breakthrough, you know, that made us, gave us an advantage over everybody else. Okay. If you didn't get it, don't worry about it. Now, why is this good for you? You don't have to integrate in time, so it's order of magnitude faster than that simulation that I showed you. We could do that simulation in 1D. It's very hard to do in 2 and 3D. Okay. We treat the openness of the cavity exactly, kind of a la Landauer and Boedecker, if you like. We treat the nonlinear interactions to infinite order. It's formulated for an arbitrary cavity, and it's easy to generalize to more than two-level atom. So how well does it work? Well, here are the numerical data integrated from those movies that I showed you. I then Fourier transform the result and plot for different frequencies the intensity as a function of pump. We have 1, 2, 3 modes lasing here. This is the total output. And then when we do it by our method, SALT, and this is with no approximation. That's the thing. It's brute force. Well, we use SALT. We're in the right regime. We get this perfect agreement here. Here's a random laser if you don't want to, you know, just treat the simple laser like this with no complexity. You can treat a random laser. Again, we can do that numerically because it's one dimension. Those are the data points, and the solid lines are what we get from SALT, which is like many orders of magnitude more efficient. Here's a realistic application to a two-dimensional photonic crystal surface emitting laser. The data points now are time domain integration, which was done at MIT with our collaborators. Took them roughly a year to get those data points, and the solid lines we got in like a week using SALT. And there was a real goal to make a high high-power single-mode semiconductor laser that this group is working on and we're trying to help them with. So the method works, and we applied it to random lasers. I'm not going to go into this, is just a cool graphic based on our calculations, I'm not going to try to talk about random lasers in this talk. It's just to say that our theory certainly showed that random lasing mathematically is exactly the same as conventional lasing, except that you have a very low Q cavity and a very complicated set of solutions with, you know, interesting statistical properties. Okay. And we also were able to use this to go back to our famous bow tie laser and actually explain the increase in the power with deformation. I don't want to go into the details of that. Okay. All right, so we have this successful semi-classical method. Very recently, I'm excited to say that we've been able to use this to actually do some quantum fluctuations. Okay. And so the most famous thing about the quantum fluctuations of a laser is that classically, the laser has zero line width. It's a perfect oscillator. Okay, and in 58, Shallow and Towns derived this formula for the Shallow-Towns line width of the laser, which the underlying physical picture, which you may have actually seen some of this already in Michel's lecture, is that you've got this perfect classical oscillator, but then you have spontaneous emission noise equivalent to one photon, which causes random jumps in the phase. And because of that, you'll have some line width, and this is the minimal line width that you can come up with, but actually, when you calculate, you see there are important corrections. So besides Shallow Towns, there were famous corrections. This is a bunch of very famous laser physicists who did this. The first thing is you have to put in the fact that you may not have perfect inversion. This assumes perfect inversion, which would mean t goes to zero from the negative direction. That's the Bose function, which becomes one as t goes to zero, and the negative absolute value becomes one as t goes to zero. This is the openness or non-hermitian factor called the Petermann factor, actually studied a lot by various people even recently. And then there's a coupling of the intensity fluctuations to the phase fluctuations, which is called the Henry alpha factor, which I will not discuss here, but later we're going to try to treat that too. Okay. Now, the essence of SALT is that the S matrix is described by this pole or set of poles on the real axis. Using this, we can actually improve on this corrected Shallow-Towns formula. So there's a diverging eigenvalue of the S matrix at the lasing frequency with some residue gamma L here, and the pole is coming to the real axis, so gamma P is going to zero. And we can calculate from SALT the eigenvector associated with that, that's the lasing mode, and therefore we have an approximate expression for the scattering matrix, which is nonlinear because it's solved from this nonlinear coupled set of equations. We know all this stuff from SALT, so we actually know what gamma L is, and we know what this lasing eigenvector of the S matrix is. And and the classical field is related to the power through this eigenvector of the S matrix. So that's the classical output field, like this straight line here, and we have to figure out the fluctuations around it. Okay. All right. Okay, I think I'll just skip through this pretty quickly since I see I'm still short on time, and just say that we can then write outgoing operators from the laser cavity in terms of this classical S matrix and some reservoir operators. We can express the time dependence of these operators in terms of a Langevin force F here. And we can define this phase function here of the field, and then calculate the correlation function of the phase, which will give us the line width. And we get a different answer from the corrected Shallow-Towns formula. This factor here, which is the residue of the lasing pole and the norm of the lasing S matrix eigenvector, replaces this quantity, which is the cold cavity line width squared and the Petermann factor. So In our view, when you do the active cavity, there is no Peterman factor. There's just this active cavity line width, which is the correct answer in the actual active lasing state. Okay, and then we applied it to a conventional cavity where the dots are what the usual shallow towns would predict, and we get pretty much the same thing. But then in a random laser, we see a big deviation from the behavior expected from shallow towns, which is this 1/power behavior. So this is very recent. I'm kind of excited about it. Just shows we can do quantum optics with this thing.
Yeah.
It can be smaller than shallow towns. So shallow towns is not a rigorous underestimate. And that's because, yeah, so that's, we discussed that and whether anyone ever claimed it was a rigorous lower bound. And apparently not.
Is that a sort of a Martian anomaly effect to compensation and fluctuations? What's...
I do not know, but I can tell you that this is the near threshold part, where the nonlinearity is small. So I think this has to do with the fact that in a random laser, the pole on the real axis is very different than the pole in the complex plane of the passive cavity. That's this gamma L squared here. So roughly speaking, it has to do with the fact that in a random laser, the pole that you pick up to the random to the real axis really has different properties. And we just discovered this is like 2 weeks, 3 weeks old, so we don't really understand it. Yep.
The earlier theory was predicated on the existence
yes.
of a round uncertain spot, but
yeah.
you can have squeezing effects.
Apparently, I mean, I really don't have, at the moment this is just showing that this formula can differ from shallow towns, but effectively there is less noise than you would have expected from the usual unsqueezed state. Yeah, I mean, yes, it's very interesting. That's all I can say. So, and you know, we wanted to find a non-trivial application. This is what we find. We see that our theory gives us the right shallow towns behavior for conventional cavities, so we believe this. But that's all I can tell you right now. I think it could be very interesting. Okay, so there are lots of advantages to SALT. I think I'll just skip through this. So that I can say something about time-reversed lasing, okay? So, So the basic idea is, well, in a laser, you have a gain medium, you put energy in, and you get coherent radiation out. And could we do this backwards? Could we send coherent radiation in, get it absorbed in the loss medium, and extract the energy? Well, of course, we can absorb incoherent light, too. There's something special about this effect that I'll explain. Okay. So now let's express it in the S matrix language. So we have S scattering alpha into beta. For the laser, alpha goes to 0. Okay, and so the laser, alpha goes to 0, and beta comes out. If we apply time reversal to this S matrix, we get a different S matrix with the star of the index of refraction. We have beta going in and alpha going out, but there's the same beta and alpha. So that means alpha is 0. So that means that for this different S matrix, when we send in the time reverse of the lasing mode, which was beta, we'll get nothing out. It'll be perfectly absorbed. And this different S matrix differs by the fact that it's absorbing. It has a loss medium instead of a gain medium. So we call this kind of cavity with a loss medium a coherent perfect absorber, or CPA. And it's a theorem of a 1-1 correspondence between lasing modes and CPA absorbers announced in this paper. In this picture where we had poles before and lasing corresponded to bringing the poles up to the real axis, now in a coherent perfect absorber, and there's some threshold amount of gain you need to do this, for the absorber you interchange gain and loss, you have interchange outgoing and incoming, and you bring a 0 of the S matrix to the real axis, and by the symmetry of the problem, it will have the same frequency as the lasing mode, and it will have the same threshold, the same amount of loss that you needed The same amount of gain that you needed, but now as loss with the plus sign, will cause this to happen. If you add more loss, then you actually miss the perfect zero. So it's not monotonic in loss. And there's a continuity argument that says for every resonance, there was a zero, and I can pull every zero through the real axis. So every one of these can be a state that's perfectly absorbed, but they are discrete points on the real axis. Okay, and it doesn't matter how complicated your system is. Here's a random laser. Here are its poles and zeros. I can put enough gain in to make a random, it lays. Here's the mode of the laser, very complicated in space. So it can perfectly absorb if I add loss, and it'll look just the same, because you won't be able to see in the complex conjugation the direction of flow. Okay. And this leads to the idea of the eigenstates of the S matrix, where S acting on psi gives me just a number times the input psi. For the laser, S goes to infinity. For the perfect absorber, S goes to zero. But the other channels are non-singular. So depending on what waveform you send in, you can either get absorption or get non-absorption. So you have coherent control of scattering. Now, was this known? Well, yes and no. The single channel case was well known. There are different devices mentioned here that are based on this. You've got a mirror. You have a partially reflecting mirror. You send in a signal. You have a lossy medium that you can tune here. And what happens is you get reflection from the front and back face, and that reflection for the correct amount of loss will destructively interfere, creating a one-way trap for light. And that's called a critically coupled cavity. And here's an example that's used in silicon integrated optics, where you have a ring, and the same kind of thing happens with this circulating wave canceling that wave. But nobody seemed to notice that this is exactly the time reverse of what a laser does. So even though this has been known for many, many years, they didn't use the relation to lasing. They didn't realize that if you had a laser that emitted into more than one electromagnetic channel, that you could control absorption using this effect. So once we realized this, we wanted to show the simplest two-channel case. This is just the one-channel case. So we looked at a lossy cavity with two inputs, two partially reflecting mirrors here. We have a 2x2 S matrix. We'll have equal inputs here with just a specific phase relationship. And so they'll come in, they'll multiply reflect and then transmit and reflect. And they have to be coherently excited from each side. And then you can have this destructive interference in this case. But this will be only one eigenvector of the S matrix. That one will have eigenvalue zero. There'll be another one that actually scatters with some strength. And because any input will be a superposition of these two, this one will be the most strongly scattered input waveform, more strongly scattered than for incoherent illumination. So we can reduce absorption as well as enhance it with this method. Okay, so here we put in these equal amplitudes with a certain phase. We have an absorbing eigenmode here with a standing wave inside, running waves outside. We have a scattering eigenmode with standing waves outside, not as much inside. And it's just an absorptive interferometer. As a function of this phase, I can go from this absorption to this scattering. Okay. And it turns out you can demonstrate this effect in intrinsic silicon near the band gap by tuning the wavelength. That's what Yidong figured out in this PRL. And it turns out for intrinsic silicon, for 100 micron cavity, it happens around 1,000 nanometers. Okay. So we did this demonstration with Wei Cao's group. We have a silicon wafer here serving as just a low-Q Fabry-Perot etalon. We have an interferometer with the phase control, and we vary the wavelength and also vary the phase. If we hit the right wavelength, we should be able to perfectly absorb. So at this wavelength, we can perfectly absorb, for example, the symmetric input, while the anti-symmetric input will be strongly scattered. And we'll just vary the phase to show that. And here's what you would predict, and here's the data. And then if we move to another wavelength, we won't have as much dynamic range when we vary the phase, so it won't go all the way down here. That's what we see. And then if we vary the wavelength here, there should be a phase-insensitive point, which they didn't quite find in the experiment, but they couldn't really continuously tune. So basically, we established this in the simplest two-channel realization, and we showed you could modulate the scattering by two orders of magnitude. Okay. Now, I won't go through the details of this since I'm running late here. I'll just give you a few final interesting comments here. Let me just show you what is possible with this idea. Now, suppose I have a more complicated system with randomness, and I put gain in the middle and I pump it, I know I can have lasing. That means if I put loss in the middle and I put the right waveform in, the time reverse of the random laser, random lasing mode, that it will find its way through all these scatterers and be absorbed in the middle. Even if this distance to the loss medium is much greater than the elastic mean free path. So this would be an object that would look opaque from the outside, but yet we could have it perfectly absorb in the middle. And that definitely can happen. You can't get this from any ray interference picture. You really need to use time reverse arguments because this is really wave chaos. Okay, and here's an example of that. Here I've put a strongly absorbing sub-wavelength object at the middle of this layer of strongly scattering non-absorbing disks. And if we could have enough gain, we could make this sub-wavelength thing lase. We don't have enough gain in nature, but we have lots of loss in nature. And so just by using this time reversal argument, this is like the time reverse of a random laser with highly localized gain medium, where the scattering transforms the near field to sub-wavelength dimensions. We should be able to find a solution to this, and we do. Okay? So that's the time reverse of the random laser. You can never make that laser because there's not enough gain in nature to do that, but you can make the time reverse. And if you can make this very complicated waveform, it will find its way through all the scatterers and be absorbed. Okay, and I have to say, ce n'est pas l'effet Fink. Vous connaissez Monsieur Fink, qui aime le time reversal. But he does time reversal in complex media by sending out from a source, an active source, the signal, and then time reversing it by various electronic techniques, et cetera. Whereas here we have a passive sync. So you can't do this broadband. He can do his trick broadband, but we can do it with a passive sync. He has to have an active sync in there to get it to work. Okay. Otherwise, it'll just for Fink, it would just reconverge and then expand again. But for us, because it's time reverse of this singularity, so it's and he agrees it isn't the same thing. He's doing lots of interesting things, but not that. Okay, I'll skip this. This is some more detail about how to do this more quantitatively. And I just want to mention the last thing very quickly because it relates to Michel's work is that you also can, something very similar to lasing is optical parametric amplification. So you're amplifying, and if you pump hard enough, the amplifier starts to oscillate. Usually they try to avoid that. But it's interesting, it's like a laser. And it turns, so you have a pump, and it starts to produce a signal and idler spontaneously. And at that threshold for oscillation, you can send in both the signal and idler, and it will recombine into the pump if you put the right phase in. And this medium has what they call a second order susceptibility. Okay. Notice what you're doing here is you're interfering outputs at different frequencies, which normally you think you can't do, but because the nonlinearity is it, you know, combines all these phases, you can actually do this as long as it's coherent inputs. This has been demonstrated in Michel's group in the gigahertz regime. He has built this Josephson parametric converter, which is a parametric amplifier using four Josephson junctions, very good one, low noise. And usually they just use it to amplify, but we suggested that they should consider putting in both the signal and idler and then looking at the output. Normally they amplify. If they only put in the signal and look at its amplification, they get out an amplified idler, you get this phase-insensitive blue line here for signal or signal only. But if you put both of them in coherently and you let the phase vary, you see there are values of the phase where suddenly, instead of amplifying, it actually converts. It puts the combines the signal and idler back into the pump, and you get strong attenuation. So that's the attenuating eigenmode of this S matrix, which you normally don't access. But if you put in that eigenvector very carefully, you can access it. And this could be interesting. You can copy a signal from the signal to the idler, it functions as a mixer and amplifier simultaneously. It also creates an autonomous feedback loop for stabilization and sensing. If I sit at this point where I'm sending in the signal and idler and it's all being converted into the pump, and then something disturbs the phase in either of the signal or an idler, I'll suddenly jump up and get a burst of signal output there. So this is something that's being explored. So I just wanted to mention that because it relates to Michel's work. I know I'm over time, so I don't think I need to go through the summary, except this is the second year of the Anti-Laser Fest. And thank you for your attention.